Oh my, oh my, oh my, what if it was true? And oh my, oh my, oh my, tell me, is it true? Diddy, 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 die upon that cross. And diddy, 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 come back across.
Walking on the water, sweet Jesus, walking in the sky.
Sinking sand, took my hand, raised me up, and he brought me up like a hill.
Jesus wrote a blank check, one I haven't cashed quite yet. I hope I got a little more time. I hope it's not the
Infants on Thrones, philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the core.
Okay, so we've got, you've made a new friend today, Randy.
I did?
Yeah, on our website. His name is Mike.
Oh, born again Mike.
He is a born again Christian.
Hi, Mike. Hey. Thanks for listening.
Every time we say born again, Mike, I think of The Office, where Michael Scott is like, I'm prison Mike. Let me tell you what it's like.
I'm prison Mike. You know why they call me prison Mike?
Do you really expect us to believe you're somebody else?
Do you really expect me to not push you up against the wall, biatch?
I came up with prison Mike during improv class, and I was doing a scene. These two college kids would not stop talking, so I became Prison Mike. And I said, hey, shut up, or I'll stab you twos. And they never said anything to me again.
Oh, and you, my friend, would be the belle of the ball. Don't drop the soap. Don't drop the soap.
And so you requested that we not be snarky.
Yes, I did.
Yeah, I want to let all the listeners know that something has changed in Randy's mind because he told me to take an appropriate tone and dial down the snark.
I just wanted it wasn't appropriate. It was
you said appropriately.
Okay.
Adverbed it.
That's okay. Yeah, you got me there. But yeah, because you can always throw that back in my face because it's typed. But anyway, you guys think that I'm just like this asshole that just like goes around and just like,
we know you,
like argues with people on the street. If I see someone with a cross, I'm going to go up, you really believe in Jesus? It's so stupid.
No, I don't think that you actually say that to them. I just know that you're thinking it.
You know that I'm thinking.
Yeah.
But this guy seems really sweet and sincere. And
Can I read him? Can I be him?
Okay, yes. But before we start, can I ask, do you guys know why the format is so weird with his comment?
No. Probably
I do.
Scott does.
I can take an educated guess. He probably typed it into some other format, and then when he pasted it into the... Because it's a long comment.
Oh, okay.
When he pasted it into the form, it transposed where the line breaks were.
Because I was looking at it, and I was like, you could read it like
it's like poetry.
You want to be snarky? Yeah, you could read it like a poem or something.
So that's kind of why, there's like a pattern with it, is because the lines, whatever he was typing it in, were probably that much wider. Like he might have been, you know, typing it in a word processing program or something.
So I want to read it. I want to read it, and then we can
before
respond
you read
to
it. Though,
come on.
Can we ask a question?
Yes.
Like, why did he single me out?
Because he heard you on another podcast. He didn't identify what that other podcast was, but he heard your interview, and it was probably the atheist one. Was it the Mormon Stories atheist interview?
Yes, okay. Going from Mormonism to atheism. It's no doubt that's what he's referencing.
Or maybe it was your voices interview. Yeah.
No.
Okay. All right.
I don't think that's really the reason why you singled him out, though.
Well, I think because Randy isn't an atheist, and I think this guy, Mike, he's another Nevermo, which I think is interesting because we've been hearing from more and more Nevermos. I want to hear from more. We need to get a Nevermo listener essay. Yeah. So he commented on the site because he heard Randy somewhere else. It could have been, what was that other podcast that you did last summer? You were on?
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
It could have been, yeah. He could have heard that. But you didn't really have much of a story on there for him to respond to, right?
Well, and this guy, it's not likely this guy's listening to the SGU.
Well, he's listening
to us.
He's listening to other things,
no,
so he's interested.
He's not listening to us. He walked into the party. He came on to, he found me. Like you were walking onto a yacht. Probably did a Google search. And saw that I was associated with this podcast. He just basically used our forum to comment to me, to basically reach out to me. I don't think he's listened to one single Infants podcast.
Okay, regardless, the reason I think he commented on here is because what he said is the part that he quotes about what you said in your interview. The first part of your interview, you said that you follow the evidence wherever, quote, you follow the evidence wherever it leads.
Yeah.
That's what excited him about it, because he thinks that if you follow this evidence, it's going to lead you somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was very, like, he starts off very empathetically, like, it must have been so hard for you.
Right.
To leave the Mormon church. So it's almost like he's doing the commitment pattern.
Almost.
Yeah. Building a relationship of trust.
Yeah.
Right. BRTing right there. And then he goes in for the attack.
Well, but he's empathizing that Mormonism is a shit religion, right?
Yeah, and he's also assuming that Mormons don't read the New Testament, but we'll get into that later.
Okay. Yeah, right. So, can I read it?
Yeah, go for it.
Hey, Randy. I like you, it says hey. I'm a born-again Christian, and I just listened to the first part of your story on another site, and I can't imagine what it would be like to be in your shoes. Wow, that would be very difficult to walk away. It takes guts. Anyway, I'm not, nor ever have been, Mormon, but the thing that stands out to me from listening to the first part of this interview is how you said you follow the evidence wherever it leads, and for whatever reason, I remembered a true crime show that I watched a while back about a man from Texas who was convicted of murdering his wife, all the while professing his innocence. After spending 25 years in jail, a nonprofit legal firm decided to look into his case, and what they found was a police interview with the man's child, who was very young at the time, but turns out that he saw his mom being murdered. Anyway, he told the police that it was not his dad, and he gave a description of the killer to them. Well, the problem was all the evidence was turned over to the defense team at the original trial except this interview, and as a result, the man was wrongly convicted and spent 25 years of his life in prison. You see, the prosecutor didn't follow the evidence wherever it led, but formed an opinion in his mind and only followed the evidence that supported his opinion, which led to a devastating result.
You can't even get through without, like, laughing.
No, I mean, the prosecutor didn't have the evidence to follow all of the evidence. But anyway, okay, we can go to that later.
Yeah.
So my question to you would be, what evidence are you following? It sounds like you're only reading books and listening to podcasts from like-minded people. I could be wrong. I said I only listened to the first part of your interview. Maybe that's the Mormon Stories interview. And so by first part, he means like the first 4 hours. But that would be like sitting on a jury in a case where only the prosecution was allowed to present its case and the defense team could only sit and watch. What do you think the verdict would be? I would challenge you to read a couple of books from an opposing point of view. Number one, Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis.
Read it.
C.S. Lewis was a scholar and professor of English literature at Oxford University and a professing atheist who, in his own words, in the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed, perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England.
Oh.
End quote. Number two. Where did I go? Okay, no, number two. Scrolling here. The Case for Christ by Lee Strobel. Have you read that one?
No.
Okay, I don't know what it is. Lee has a master's degree from Yale Law School and was the legal editor of the Chicago Tribune, also an atheist, who decided to put Christianity on trial, just like the legal cases he had covered as a journalist to prove Christianity wrong. This book chronicles his investigations into the facts. In Lee's words, quote, "Some point during my investigation, I came to a point where I said, I want to know the truth. If Buddhism is correct, I'll become a Buddhist. If Mormon is it, I'll be a Mormon. If the evidence leads to there is no God, I'll live my life accordingly. But I want to know the truth," end quote. Lee gave his life to Christ. With a razor blade. I don't know how he did it. Also, read the New Testament, written by eyewitnesses to the life, death, and... Also, read the New Testament, written by eyewitnesses to the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. That's where I would start.
Good place.
Also, if you go to Quave.com, K-Wave.
K-Wave.
K-Quave. I don't know. Who knows?
I think that's a drink that Polynesians use. It's a sedative. Quave?
Yeah, something like that. Right, yeah. Listen to a program called Pastor's Perspective. It's a call-in radio show where people ask questions and a couple of Christian pastors answer them. Or a website called His Channel. Or
His Channel. Capital H. Capital H.
His.
I think it's His Channel.
His Channel. HisChannel.com. There is lots of research material there. I hope this challenges you, Randy, to seek truth with a capital fucking T. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. 17. For God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him.
Yeah, I don't understand this biblical language. It's not 16th century English.
It's not the right version.
Yeah, it's like, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him shall not perish. But this is weird.
Isn't it supposed to be everlasting? I don't know.
Well, no, I think it's eternal.
I believe in those two verses in as much as they are translated correctly, and I'm just not sure about the wording here.
All right. First of all, Mike. Born again, Mike.
I'm prison Mike.
If you're listening, this podcast has colorful, aka salty language. And if that offends your Christian sensibilities, then push stop now, because this is for the grown-ups.
Oh, there's grown-ups who don't swear, Randy. Come on. You're the one who said not to be snarky, and you're being condescending right from the start about swearing.
You were laughing the whole time.
I know.
And you said a capital fucking T.
That's right.
So
that's my favorite part.
You're rubbing off on me, man.
I'm just saying, if Mike, if you don't like cussing, then tune out now, because you know it's going to happen.
Don't bullshit me. It's a free country, asshole. But don't try no bargain trick. What a mouth on that guy.
Have you guys known many born again Christians?
Yeah.
Ooh, I have.
I haven't, but talk about it a little bit.
Go ahead.
Arm wrestle for it.
I've known many, because my mom was once one.
Yeah.
And so I used to go to a church, several churches actually, before I converted to Mormonism, where they were born again Christian people.
Yeah, were you ever born again?
I have been born again like 3 or 4 times.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because it's like a weird. So if you go to a different church, then the pastor does the call to, you know, the call, whatever. I don't know what they call it. Where they're like, if any of you feel like you need to come to Jesus, then come to Jesus.
So like in the middle of the meeting, the sermon, he'll invite people up to the front. And then is it a baptism? Is there a ceremony, or is it just
it's just
manifest?
Like, yeah, that's like when you're born again. That's like
So did you feel it? Like the 3 times when you were born again, did you feel that like spirit and transformation and stuff? It was a spiritual experience for you?
Well, let me explain why I did it so many times. First of all, is because it kind of feels like it will, if I'm in a different church, then I should probably do it again. So this pastor knows that I'm born again.
That you're serious.
I don't know. But anyway, I think that I felt very emotional and very grateful and very kind of like a wash of relief. You know what I mean? Like kind of like when you're sitting in testimony meeting as a Mormon and you feel like you should go up there, you should go up there, you should go up there. Mm-hmm. And you don't for the longest time. And then when you finally do get up there and you like are crying and it was kind of like that feeling where you're just.
So you were crying?
Oh yeah.
Did you speak in tongues?
I have spoken in tongues, you guys. Wow. Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. Okay. Oh,
that's awesome.
Awesome.
Super weird.
Did he did the pastor like smack you on the forehead and fall down on the ground or anything like that?
Oh no, but I've seen that happen.
Yeah. Demons be gone.
Yeah.
So
it was weird.
So like when you had that experience speaking in tongues, was that something that you were conscious of, or it felt like it came upon you and it happened to you?
It was something that when I did it was like, there's two different experiences that I had with it. The first one, we had like a class about how to speak in tongues and how to receive that gift. Yeah. Wow.
My name is Reverend Sonia, and today I'd like to talk to you about speaking in tongues and how to speak in tongues. This is going to be a series of videos. By the time we're done, you should be not only speaking in tongues, but you should be using tongues as very, very powerfully in your life. So if you have concerns about your family, about your friends, about your community, about your government, even if you have concerns about the weather, your business, any kind of concerns in your life, speaking in tongues is a very, very powerful tool that you can use. And when you do use it, you will see miracles if you know how to use it properly.
Oh, 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 it's magic, you know.
Class? I thought that was just a gift bestowed upon you with the magic wand of God.
Avada Kedavra.
I thought so too. So when we had the class, it was a little strange for me, but we were really young. Like, I think I was like 12 or 13. So I figured maybe I'm just not old enough to understand. I don't know. I just went with it. I had a lot of friends there, and it was very weird. Like, I knew I was faking it the whole time. I mean, I knew that I was just like mumbling mumbo jumbo that didn't make sense, but having sort of feelings attached to what I was mumbling, mm-hmm.
No, it totally makes sense. I get it.
Yeah.
A Mormon would say that it's not truly the gift of tongues unless there's someone there to interpret it.
Yeah.
Right, and that it's like a pure message being communicated through the Adamic language, and someone can interpret it to everyone's edification. But that's like old Kirtland Mormonism.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. that hasn't been around for...
Yeah. Never. And then the other time I saw people speaking in tongues was at a different church that I had been born again in. And this guy was the pastor was giving a sermon, and I guess one of the people in the congregation, he like really was feeling it. And so he stood up and started speaking in tongues like during the middle of the sermon. And everybody kind of turned and looked at him. They were kind of like, wow, that's wonderful that he's feeling so strong about this. But the pastor was like, now is not the time. Please sit down.
You're stealing my thunder.
Yeah. It was pretty funny.
Wow.
That actually happened with Joseph Smith when someone else came up with their own seer stone.
Right.
He's like, No. I'm the one with the seer stones.
So, Scott, what's your experience been with the born agains?
Well, like I had an experience where it was my first semester at college, and we had a very secular professor, and I had stuck up for religion in my English 101 class, or English 102, and after class, really pretty girl came up to me and said, "Are you a believer?"
And then I saw her face.
And I'm like, "What? What are you talking
about?"
You're
like, "Hell yeah."
Yeah, I'm like, "Yeah, I'm a believer. What are you talking about?" And so she was born again Christian, but was really kind of sort of interested in the church. And so I actually took her to, I think it was the temple Easter or no Christmas pageant thing. And her family was like all over me because they thought I was going to corrupt her with my Mormonism. Yeah. And then they were trying to kind of convert me. And so it was like this back and forth thing with her. And really nice girl, but it was the first time I'd really encountered it. And when I spent some time in their home and got to know their family and prayed with their family and read scriptures with their family and that sort of thing. And just really got a different perspective on how I'd never met anyone who was that literal with the Bible. I mean, she's even now I'm Facebook friends with her and she is a diehard Noah's Ark was literal. Yeah. You know, Answers younger. In Genesis, young earth creationist type person. And I don't know if born again Mike is that way, but I think most people who identify as born again Christian in the United States probably are in that camp. So I'm fine to stereotype somebody I've never met.
No, I'd put money on Mike, born again Mike, being that way.
Yeah.
If for no other reason than the punctuation errors. But
I would bet dollars to donuts.
Yeah.
He is a young earth creationist and believes that Noah and the flood is historical.
Yeah, he seems young. He seems like that's what I read, like young and like full of passion and spirit, and you know, like that same
piss and vinegar.
Yeah, that same drive that drove us when we were missionaries. You know, to really share what we believed and just loved. And that's kind of the sense that I get. For I could be wrong. So Scott, when you said that was your freshman year in college, was it pre-mission or post-mission?
Pre-mission.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and so when I got my mission call, it was like really kind of awkward because you know we built this relationship. It was never romantic, although it was kind of teetering on the edge of romantic, but it was weird when I got my mission call. Cause it was like, yeah, I'm really going to go, you know? And that was kind of when she realized that I wasn't going to,
there was no future.
Convert. Yeah. There's no future. Yeah. And I wasn't going to convert to what she was selling either. So
I remember, I think the first time I ever encountered someone who was born again, I was probably like 15 or 16 years old, and I was in San Diego for a summer vacation, and just this guy on the beach, he was probably in his 20s or 30s, and you know, one of those guys that had, he tells the story of his down and out life, being addicted to drugs, and then almost, I remember it was cocaine, and he almost died, and then he had this experience, you know, where he's like born again. And so he was really on fire about it. And I was equally on fire about, you know, Mormonism. Like, I was like, that's awesome, man. You've taken your first step. Now let me bring you the rest of the way. And, you know, like 15 years old. And he wasn't buying any of that. But we just had, like, it wasn't like Bible bashing or confrontational at all. It was just fun. I really liked it. So I kind of was hoping that I would get more of that on my mission. But then I, you know, went to Japan and there wasn't any Bible bashing or anything like that there.
See, we had tons of that in Korea.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Korea is like 40-45% Christian, and a lot of them are very, very evangelical.
Yeah.
Just born again. I mean, it's just millions and millions of people like that. So
born again Mike.
I'm prison Mike.
List several evidences here. You know, mere Christianity. Randy, you said that you've read that, so maybe we could talk about that a little bit. But let's talk about the eyewitnesses to the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. You know, I mean, what makes me think that he's kind of young.
Right. So the problem is there aren't any eyewitness accounts of the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. There are none that we have that are recorded.
Right.
Yeah, not only that, Jesus never wrote anything down. So we don't know anything that was truly in.
Nothing's firsthand.
Nothing's firsthand.
And nothing's even secondhand.
No one even claims that Jesus wrote anything down. So, you know, everything is after the fact. And I'm not going to get ahead of myself before we get into C.S. Lewis. But
why not start with the New Testament? I mean, the New Testament came before C.S. Lewis did, just not in his post.
Right. And people will look at it and say, well, Peter was one of Christ's disciples, and he wrote these books. But every scholar will tell you out there that those, and the Catholic Church, I think, even as well, doesn't think that any of those books were actually authored by Peter that claimed that they were.
Yeah, what about John? John the Beloved.
John.
Yeah. Well, I guess he's immortal, right?
do other religions believe that, or is it just Mormons that believe that John
that's
was...
just more.
All right, let me just break in for a minute, because I was listening to this with my wife, and she stopped it here, and she said, wait a minute, John was immortal? What the hell are you talking about? All right, so first of all, there's this cryptic verse in the New Testament where John, the one who Jesus loved, is said to tarry until Christ returns again. This is from John chapter 21.
Peter, seeing him, saith to Jesus, Lord, and what shall this man do? Jesus saith unto him, If I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee? Follow thou me. Then went this saying abroad among the brethren, that disciple should not die. Yet Jesus said not unto him, He shall not die, but if I will that he tarry till I come, what is that to thee?
So this is right there in the King James Version of the Bible, which was the version that Joseph Smith read as a kid, right? And you know there must have been discussions about this. You know, it was one of those mysteries or curiosities that fueled occasional late-night discussion, because, you know, with God, nothing is impossible. So my guess is that this was probably floating around in the ether. Now, remember who we're dealing with here. This is Joseph Smith, who was like the Paul Harvey of the Bible.
Now you know the rest of the story.
And anything you could do.
Any note you can hold, I can hold longer.
I can hold any note longer than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, no, I can.
Ugh. But you get the idea, right?
I see your John and raise you 3 Nephites.
So, in the Book of Mormon, Joseph Smith, in true pseudepigraphal style, elaborates on what it means to tarry, with his story where the same thing that happened to John happened to 3 Nephites in America. This is Book of Mormon, 3rd Nephi, chapter 28.
And he said unto them, Behold, I know your thoughts. And ye have desired the thing which John, my beloved, who was with me in my ministry before that I was lifted up by the Jews, desired of me.
Can we pause for a moment here and just revel in the brilliant eloquence of that last statement?
John, my beloved, who was with me in my ministry before that I was lifted up by the Jews, desired of me.
Ah, that sucks so bad.
Therefore, more blessed are ye, for ye shall never taste of death. But ye shall live to behold all the doings of the Father unto the children of men, even until all things shall be fulfilled according to the will of the Father, when I shall come in my glory with the powers of heaven. And ye shall never endure the pains of death, but when I shall come in my glory, ye shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye from mortality to immortality, and then shall ye be blessed in the kingdom of my Father. And again, ye shall not have pain while ye shall dwell in the flesh, neither sorrow, save it be for the sins of the world. And it came to pass that when Jesus had spoken these words, he touched every one of them with his finger, save it were the 3 who were to tarry.
Now, isn't it just fascinating and truly faith-affirming that the word tarry came through with such purity from that Reformed Egyptian? Not to mention how cool it is that Jesus would be so clear about that John guy on the other side of the world, you know, his sort of ex-girlfriend who these Nephites could never have possibly heard of or really even cared about all that much, but somehow those of us reading in our day would be able to know and tie all those things together. I mean, such magnificent foreknowledge. Wow, everything happens for a reason. But Joseph wasn't finished telling
the rest of the story
about John, the beloved terrier. Because he also tied him to the lost tribes of Israel, that John was with them, teaching them, ministering unto them, and that when they returned, John would pretty much lead the way. Now, this was John's special mission, and we get this from Doctrine and Covenants, section 77.
Question. What are we to understand by the little book which was eaten by John, as mentioned in the 10th chapter of Revelation? Answer. We are to understand that it was a mission and an ordinance for him to gather the tribes of Israel.
So, there you go. That's why Randy chuckled when we joked that writing as an eyewitness of the life, death, and resurrection of Christ isn't quite as impossible as it might sound 150 years after the fact if, you know, you're an immortal, beloved terrier. Sorry.
I had never heard that before I was a Mormon, yeah. So.
Yeah, that's a Mormon thing.
Okay. But there's a movie called The Seventh Seal.
The Seventh Sign.
Have you guys seen that movie?
Yeah.
But it wasn't John. It was like a Roman soldier, like the Roman soldier who stabbed Jesus with the spear or something like that, that he had been cursed to live forever. It was something like that. I remember watching that. That was another one I watched as a teenager, and I thought, they're so close to the truth on that. They're so close.
Yeah, but just not quite there.
There was Demi Moore. Yeah, Demi Moore was in that one.
Yeah, and somebody stabbed Jesus, and like light came out of him, and he was like this cool, like hippie, like Jesus.
Yeah,
modern Jesus.
I should watch that again. It's been years since then. 20 years more.
Yeah, he's like that. I've already been killed once. I can't be killed again.
So, according to modern scholarship, John did not write the Gospel of John.
Yeah,
it was written about 100 AD. So. John would have had to have been about 150 years old.
And one of the reasons why, or one of the things that gives it away in there, is how emphatic John is about the fact that he saw these things firsthand with his own eyes, and he's the one who's writing it, and his name is John. And did he mention that he's seen it with his own eyes?
Is he that emphatic about the birth, you know, death?
John does not have anything about the birth of Jesus.
Okay. Right.
The only ones that have the birth of Jesus is Luke and Matthew, and they absolutely contradict each other. In Matthew, the Magi come to visit Joseph and Mary with their, you know, newborn king in their home in Bethlehem. In Luke, they contrive this absolutely absurd and totally falsifiable story of a census where everyone in the whole kingdom
had
to migrate. Yeah, what'd I say?
Consensus.
Oh, sorry. Census. Everyone had to migrate to the home of their birth, you know, like their heritage. It's like, do you guys know who you descended from 1,000 years ago? It's like it's so patently absurd and ridiculous, the Luke 2 story, that even the church has made a video on. That story is a joke. It's all about trying to reconcile that the historical Jesus actually came from Nazareth, but the Messiah has to come from the city of David, a.k.a. Bethlehem.
So they had to come up with a reason why Jesus would have been born in Bethlehem, but everybody knew that he was a Nazarene. Right. Right. And being from Nazareth was kind of like being from like Apache Junction, Arizona.
Yeah.
Like it's just from
white
some
trash.
It's just like this backwater place where it was very blue collar. There was no culture there. It was all just kind of peasant laborers who would go to the big cities and work. But it was in no way connected with any of the prophecies, and yet that's obviously where Jesus was from.
Yeah, and that's the strongest evidence that there was a historical Jesus. Otherwise, they would have just created the story out of whole cloth and not have to come up with a reason why he's a Nazarene, but actually he was born in Bethlehem. But the thing that stood out to me, and for about a month I was a Christian after I left the Mormon Church, was that when you look at Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and that's the order that biblical scholars think that they were written in, and there's a lot of evidence for that, is that in Mark, The Jesus there is the suffering servant. You know, he doesn't do any miracles in public. Everything he does, every miracle he does, he tells the apostles, don't tell anyone. It's all secret. At his baptism, it doesn't say, this is my beloved son. It says, you are my beloved son. So that implies that the only one that heard that was Jesus. And then when he gets crucified, he's like, he doesn't know what's happening. He's wondering why he's forsaken. And then it ends. And by the time you get to John, 30 years later, he's fucking Jesus Christ superstar. Like, he just is walking around saying, I am God. Zap, pow, wah. You know, he's just showing everybody. And so you see over 30 years, the building of a legend, you know. And to me, that was like, oh, this is so obvious.
Do you think the resurrection motif in that legend was just a literary device? Because people are like, how would you know what Jesus was thinking when he was on the cross? And then they're all, because he came back and told us.
No, there's a lot of there. So
I'm just kidding.
So in terms of a biblical criticism, yeah, I know you're kidding. But in terms of kind of a criticism on just Christology in general, there's a huge number of the things associated with Christ that were adopted from other religious traditions that were already in the cultural
milieu. Say the word milieu.
Milieu that they were in. So
it's a good word.
Thanks.
Everything from dying and being raised on the third day, being born of a virgin, the stories about casting out demons, stories. I mean, there's so many parts of Christ's life that were just obviously adopted from other religious narratives.
And when you're talking, if you want to get really pedantic about legends, you'd talk about these motifs. These are motifs, and that you'd be able to find those motifs in other tale types and other places, which is an indication of, you know, like you've heard me talk before about the fingerprints of human creation. You can see that in the Christ story. But I think, you know, like if we're talking to you, born again Mike, I think what I want you to know, and probably the other guys here as well, is we went from a place of being believers to being very skeptical about what we used to believe. And the reason we did that is because we did look at other evidence and other perspectives. And, you know, so we're talking here about scholarship on who wrote the Bible, whether we're talking about the Old Testament or the New Testament. There's a lot that's out there that you can read that doesn't reinforce the believing viewpoint that you're raised with. I think that's one of the things that budged us from where we were before. It's not just Mormonism is an obvious fraud. It was reading these other things and, you know, learning critical thinking skills and other things like that did it for us.
Well, and I think specifically every one of us on our way out of Mormonism had to get not only out of Mormonism, but out of Christianity. So there's like
we may have started a little bit out of Christianity to be fair, but yeah.
Well, some people more than others. Yeah. I mean, like how Randy had to deal with that, and I kind of went through a similar process, although it probably wasn't a month for me, but I was, you know, as a Mormon, as someone who's gone through seminary, you're gonna study the New Testament for a full year. You study the Old Testament for a full year.
But you're not
Sunday school.
You're not getting the Christian New Testament or the Christian Old Testament. You're getting the Mormon version of it. So, you know, like I made the joke at the beginning, we believe this as far as it's translated correctly, but the entire Mormon church is built on this premise that all the other Christian churches are in error. So, like, we've already got a foot out of Christianity as Mormons, right?
That's true. But what I'm getting at is somebody like Born Again Mike comes and says, hey, why don't you try reading the New Testament? And it's like, are you kidding me? Because how many times have I read the New Testament as a Mormon?
Right.
You know?
God. Look at my missionary Bible. It is like cross-reference colored. Yeah. I read that thing
all over the New Testament.
Yeah.
Like, don't come to me and tell me to go read the New Testament. That's just arrogant. Like, it's so arrogant.
Oh, like you've never done it, Scott.
Yeah, when we were missionaries and we're kids. Yeah.
No, so that's what's fun. That's what's funny is my reflection on reading this. At first, I was like, who is this arrogant prick coming to tell me about religion? You know? And then I'm thinking, like, oh, I kind of did that for 2 years.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
On about 12 million apartment doors
right,
in Korea.
Right. Yeah, so, not on somebody's website anonymously, but yeah. To their face, at their door.
No, my door approach was like, Hey! There's God speaking to us through a prophet, and he has a message for you. Will you open the door, please? Yeah, it was pretty subtle.
Yeah.
But I was never really comfortable with that. But that's.
I think it's easier in a foreign language,
and it's harder to knock on a teepee.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So you talked about, or we talked about, kind of where we've come from. But let's talk about this idea that he brings up about giving, you know, giving the other side of an argument a fair chance.
Well, let's give the counter argument to his courtroom anecdote. And this is really kind of a silly exercise anyway. This is what I call the dueling anecdotes, which, in political arguments is a total waste of time. But to me, the counter to that is how many people, mostly guys, because guys are the ones that rape, have been sent to jail on eyewitness accounts, and DNA has exonerated them. They were not the perpetrators. But the eyewitness accounts, which are incredibly fallible and totally unreliable, put a guy in jail for 20 years until DNA evidence or DNA technology came about, and guys are being set free all the time based on new DNA evidence, and they were put in jail for what? Eyewitness accounts.
But hang on, Randy, because I'm sure Born Again Mike,
I'm Prison Mike,
has used this courtroom analogy in other places, and it's intentionally setting up the credibility of an eyewitness account, because you're setting up the big payoff with the New Testament and those eyewitness accounts there.
Right.
So, come on.
No,
what's your point?
It's important.
You're absolutely
don't take that
right.
away from Born Again Mike.
Who's right?
Randy.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
You're right.
Okay. I just wanted to hear that.
Does that make you feel better?
Oh, God. You have no idea.
Do you want me to put the whole line together? Randy was right there.
That's why he listens to us. Yeah. We're like-minded.
Yeah.
So eyewitness accounts are some of the worst evidence that you can possibly have, but it's something that convinces people because they want to believe that someone else who's so sure of something that they actually saw it correctly. But they've done a lot of studies with people, you know, looking at someone, seeing someone for a short period of time, and then picking them out of a lineup, and they're terrible at it. I mean, the statistics on it are just, they're shocking. And that's why there's so many people who have been exonerated by DNA and other evidence when they were convicted wrongly on eyewitness accounts. If you're interested in this, I would encourage you to go listen to, there's a really great Radiolab episode. I don't know if you guys have listened to it about a woman who was raped, and it's a horrible story.
Right.
And she sent this guy to prison, and it turned out it wasn't actually him.
I just got chills, man.
Spoiler alert. And it's just this, there's more to the story too. So that doesn't totally ruin it, but it's just harrowing. Yeah. Oh, it's just, I mean, you can't even imagine it. The other thing that I wanted to point out.
Well, because I'm just saying, because it highlights her guilt, sending a man to prison. And it's horrible on so many levels.
Well, and she really screwed him up too, mm-hmm. by doing that. So, the other thing I wanted to point out here is there's different kinds of evidence. So the evidence of the story in this, or the evidence of this kid in the story saying that wasn't my dad, okay, that's probably sufficient evidence to exonerate someone, but it's not necessarily sufficient evidence to convict someone. So we have different standards of how we would treat that kind of evidence if I were a juror on a case like that, I would have no problem exonerating someone on the evidence of a four-year-old, but I would have a huge problem with convicting someone on the evidence of a four-year-old.
Right. It's the old...
Your levels of certainty are so different.
Yeah, because that goes back to one of our founding fathers that says it's better that 1,000 guilty men go free than one innocent man get convicted. And that's kind of what our justice system was based on. That's why we have that mantra, innocent until proven guilty, because it was the opposite before that. You were guilty until proven innocent. And so that's why the evidence is weighted differently. Is that right, Scott?
Yeah, that's part of my point. But there's disconfirming evidence and there's confirming evidence. So you might have evidence that you think is confirming of something, like a spiritual witness, you think is confirming evidence. But if there's disconfirming evidence out there, like, oh, I don't know, that the thing you had the spiritual witness of is a fraud, or that the Book of Mormon isn't historical, you have to weigh the quality of your evidence of one thing, your spiritual witness, on the other hand, against hard evidence that demonstrates that's not true. That's like weighing eyewitness testimony against DNA testimony. You can't just treat all evidence as if they're the same thing.
Can I ask a question? And this might be a little bit of a tangent, but when you're talking about feelings as evidence or as a confirmation, and Allison, maybe you have some experience with this from your Christian background, but I remember having a conversation maybe 10, 15 years ago with somebody that I knew from work, and they were evangelical Christian, I don't know, born again, but they also saw Mormons as really bad, and they were trying to save my soul. And I was explaining to them how I gained a testimony through feeling it, and they were really dismissive of it. And there's almost like I've heard it other places before, like when Christians are being anti-Mormon, and I'm putting that in air quotes, they really attack the feelings that Mormons get. They know it's true because of their feelings. But then when they describe their born-again experiences, I never understood how that could be
different.
Yeah, how's it different? How can they compartmentalize go after ours, but then completely validate theirs? So do you guys have an answer to that?
Yeah, so there's a psychological phenomenon called elevation, which is basically what a lot of people associate feeling the spirit with. My friend James Rogers did a big presentation on this, where he compared quotes from every religion, and including atheists and agnostics and Buddhists and every group, every religious group you can think of.
Did he post it in Mormon Bulletin?
He probably did.
Okay. I'll go listen.
Jeez, Glenn, come on.
Thanks for the plug.
Hey, got to help him out.
Yeah. So, but it's really interesting. I mean, the quotes are virtually identical in terms of physically how they feel it, you know, the kind of tingling, the warmness in your heart, feeling like you're lightened or lifted up, or you're, you know, it's a light on you kind of a thing, to overwhelming feelings of peace. I mean, they're very, very similar experiences, and there's psychological mechanisms that they've traced to this, and psychologists call it elevation.
But so how is theirs different than ours?
It's not. Okay. But I want to hear Allison's take.
Yeah.
Well, so I remember when I first, when I was born again the first time, I did have really strong feelings, like those elevation feelings you're talking about. And if you've ever been to like a really great concert, it's the same kind of thing though. But I think since I hadn't ever done anything else that was so, put so much adrenaline through my body and also made me think of things that were really important and special to me, that was like a really amazing feeling for me. But I think that what stood out for me, the difference between Mormonism and their feeling it, is that when you go to a Mormon church and see people just sitting and like, or a big thing for me was when a musical number would get finished and nobody would clap. They just
You do not clap in the chapel.
No, never. But not being used to that, I felt like this is not the same thing. Like, so mm-hmm. how can you trust your feeling of God being inside of you when you're just sitting there? Like, it doesn't even make you jump up and shout. It doesn't make you show any kind of real emotion other than crying, usually, is the yeah. only one you see.
You got to be so reverent.
Right. You need to be reverent. So that's how I worked it out in my mind at first before I converted, that it's not the same kind of, it's not God. It's not the same.
But you still converted to Mormonism? You just didn't feel that the spirit of God was there?
Well, what then I had to do was I think that I convinced myself that what I had felt in other churches wasn't really the spirit. It was just emotion.
Counterfeit.
And yeah, it was counterfeit because it was so exciting and because it did have all that fun music and all the clapping and the shouting, and that kind of covered up the actual what the actual Holy Spirit felt like. And so then when I joined the Mormon church, it kind of felt like a quieter, like, this is just a good choice for you.
More sacred and solemn and yeah. respectable.
Yeah, good, which respectable. Was also very different for me, which was, you know, I wasn't used to that either. So it made an impact on me, I guess, to feel that way.
Well, and Mormonism's weird with that. It's kind of weird that way because it doesn't have, at least in terms of the chapel service, there's no like high church rituals, right? It's very much like a low church, like the liturgy and all of the ordinances mm-hmm. are very calm. There's nothing's ornate, nothing's particularly exciting. It's just kind of something that could be recreated in any gym in any building in the world, right? Like
you just need
a microphone and some metal folding chairs and you're good to go.
Yeah, Mormonism seemed to gravitate over time to the most boring parts of Protestantism. And you know, the hymns are like plodding and boring, and everyone is like proper and reverent, and you know, it's just like when we'd bring an investigator who came from kind of the tradition that Allison came from. It was like they were just like, really? This is how you worship?
Yeah, it's weird.
It's like, where's the drum kit?
Yeah. Where's the fun? Well, where's the excitement?
Everybody looks grumpy, you know, like, and tired, and there's just no liveliness at all.
People are falling asleep, and it's totally normal.
See, then why aren't more people following that as evidence that the Mormon church is not true? Huh?
I think they are.
Okay. Yeah.
So Alice, to get to your point, are you kind of comparing that? Like, I'm thinking about it the other way around. Like, I know Mormons who have gone to, you know, Europe and things like that, and you go into a big cathedral, and people will just be like, "Oh, it's such a negative energy that's there. It's so, you know, it's just devoid of the spirit because it's Gothic architecture, and there's shadows, and there's gargoyles, and there's, you know, things." It's just so much more diverse, and it's so uncomfortable to them that they can't imagine how that would feel like, you know, elevating in terms of their spiritual experience. Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah. It's just very jarring when you're not used to that. And so you put a negative spin on it and confirm to your own biases. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's get back on track after this tangent. And, let's talk about his first challenge was for me to read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. So my story with that is during that month when I, you know, was trying to grab onto anything, Christianity was like the obvious choice. Two friends of mine challenged me to read Mere Christianity, and both of them were Mormon. One of them was in the midst of the same faith crisis I was. We kind of went into it together. And the other one had his faith crisis a couple years before. And this born-again Mike used an argument from authority that this Strobel guy had a law degree from Yale, which means he's really smart. Well, this guy had a master's degree from Harvard in theology, and he was Mormon, but kind of a liberal Mormon. And so the challenge was, let's get on Skype, let's read, three or four chapters at a time of Mere Christianity, and let's discuss it. And the guy who had the theology degree from Harvard told me this was, to him, the greatest work of literature in the 20th century as far as Christianity was concerned. And so I was expecting a lot. And so when we would get on Skype and discuss it, it always devolved because I was always so disappointed in the arguments that C.S. Lewis would bring up. Have any of you read Mere Christianity?
Yep. Yeah, I read it.
So the first part of the book is building the case for any God existing. And he appeals to this moral, there's some kind of moral commonality in all societies, which I call bullshit on. And because of this moral, the reality of this universal moral code, then that is evidence that that's something outside of reality.
Okay, can I stop you there for a bit? I just want to make sure I understand. When you're saying commonalities, because I haven't read Mere Christianity, when you're talking about the commonalities, you mean like don't lie, don't kill, don't commit adultery. Things that you might be able to put in like a Ten Commandments kind of thing, that it's pervasive, and he's trying to say because those are there, there's a single source of inspiration for it all. Is that his argument?
Yeah, but the thing is that you have to boil it down. You have to like back off so far away from all the cultures to find some kind of commonality,
right?
And really, it becomes a really weak argument. And so, even if you grant the premise that there is some commonality, I mean, actually, if you take what is moral in the Spartan community and compare it to the United States of America today, there's no resemblance. They value way, their assumptions and their premises are so different. It's laughable. But let's say we grant that.
Do you have any examples of that, like slavery?
Yeah. Well, in the Spartan community, or in Athens, they used to take 10-year-old boys. They would be kind of like apprentices to adult men, but they were sexual in nature. Right. 10-year-old boys, and that was completely normal. In Sparta, I think it was at age 7, they would be shipped off to become soldiers. And, giving your life to the lifestyle of a soldier was the highest moral thing that any parent could do, to send their kid off to go fight and die. Just like all the basics of the foundation of certain societies, they're not common at all.
Yeah, you can, but if you look around hard enough, you can find major exceptions to pretty much any rule that you would think is universally applicable. If you go, like, I took an ethics class in college where the professor went through this in pretty fine detail, and it's like, okay, taking care of the elderly. Well, the Eskimos just kind of ship them out on the ice, so that one doesn't apply universally. Not eating other humans. Well, there's cultures where that was totally fine. Not raping women. Well, no, there's cultures where that's totally fine too. So there's, there's so many examples of it, and every one of these things as well. Like, I think what a lot of evangelicals don't realize is that we now, sitting here in the 21st century, probably are disgusted by the morality that's put forward in the Bible. So look at the morality that's put forward in the Bible by Yahweh and tell me that's something that you really want to get behind.
Yeah. So Moses,
I'd turn that one right around on Christianity.
Yeah. Right. Moses commands his troops to go in and slaughter every man, woman, and child and beast of the Midianites. Well, they don't. They spare the women and the children. And then they come back, and Moses is pissed off. And he says, now go back and kill every man, woman, and child, but spare the virgins and bring them back. The morality of the Bible is repugnant to 21st century Americans.
That's God speaking through Moses.
Right, exactly. Yahweh.
Yeah, Yahweh was telling Moses to do that.
But even if you grant the premise that there is some fine line of commonality in morality throughout all cultures, then he makes the leap that that is God.
An evidence of God is the source for that.
And that's a huge fucking leap. You know, especially in light of all the evolutionary psychology and all the work that's been done in evolution. You just look at bats, vampire bats. So vampire bats are our closest relatives outside of primates, other primates. And they have a moral code within their society that you share your blood. So everyone goes out, some are successful, some are not, in getting blood. And then you share. Those who are successful share with those who weren't. Someone who won't share, they attack it and they kill it. So that's like a rudimentary moral code that is evidenced in evolution, with really close relatives. And so you can see, and there's all kinds of things in chimpanzees, reciprocity, altruism. You can see that in meerkats.
There's a sense of fairness, and they'll cheat on each other. If they can see that the other one's not looking, they'll cheat on them. Yeah.
I've heard though that the bonobos have a different type of sexual morality.
yeah, they do.
But what you're getting at, Randy, and for me, this is reason enough to dismiss C.S. Lewis or anyone else, is he doesn't believe in evolution. So,
well,
he can't make that argument.
In the book,
he can't understand that argument.
He's weird. He's kind of like an old earth creationist. He does not discount evolution in the book Mere Christianity. But he does believe that Adam and Eve existed. So I don't know how he works that out. But then you get to part two. And so in part one, he's just trying to establish that there is a God. Part two, he's trying to establish that Jesus is that God. And that's where you get to the really bad arguments. Glenn, remember we did the Screwtape Letters?
Yeah.
And in the Screwtape Letters, we were kind of like a little bit taken aback by his misogyny. But that's kind of a fallacy of presentism where, we're kind of judging him by the social mores and the morality of today. Right. His misogyny is also in Mere Christianity. And he talks about, he compares Christianity to other belief systems like Hinduism, and he calls Christianity as a manly religion. It's a manly religion. Literally, look it up. It's in the fucking book. He calls it a manly religion.
So if it gets your testosterone flowing, it must be true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then he builds to his climax. This is his climax, that Jesus is one of three things. He creates a false trichotomy. He is either a liar, a lunatic, or the Lord.
Wow, they all start with L.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, guess what L pattern, he forgot?
He got the alliteration.
Well, guess what L he forgot?
What's that?
Legend.
Mm.
Oh, Newman! So he's saying either Jesus was a lunatic, I think the quote is at the level of declaring himself a poached egg in the book.
What?
If Jesus said that he is God, that is at the level of saying that you're a poached egg. So he's either a lunatic that's declaring that he's God, or he's a liar and saying that he's, seen all these things and that God has told him that he's the Son of God, blah, blah, blah. Or he's the Lord. And he if you read the Gospels, he clearly can't be a liar or a lunatic because he seems reasonable.
Right.
So the only reasonable
conclusion is Lord. The only possible thing left. Yeah.
It's Lord. Wow. But he leaves out legend, you know, which is like Jesus never wrote anything down. And so a legend can build around a person. Legends have built around all kinds of people in history. And so it's the arguments are so pedestrian and so lame that I was told
this is the fifth L.
This is the greatest apologist of the 20th century, and like this is all he's got. It was it totally turned me off. Mere Christianity turned me off of Christianity. And I had to sit down and have Skype conversations with people about this.
Why would it turn you off of Christianity instead of just turning you off of C.S. Lewis?
Because he was supposed to be the best.
He was supposed to be the best that they had to offer. And I'd come from the world of Mormon apologetics, and they were all lame. And then I get to Christianity, and it was just as lame.
Yeah.
And so then I started reading Bart Ehrman books, and I started to learn and listen to other podcasts like Reasonable Doubts and Reasonable Doubt, I think is what it's called. And I started to learn about redactive criticism. And that's when I started to learn about how the legend built from Mark to John, from the suffering servant to Jesus Christ superstar. And then I'm like, oh, this is so obvious. And that's really what you want to talk about, Glenn, is like, how far am I supposed to go? Is anyone supposed to go before they can reasonably conclude that this is has the fingerprints of man on it?
And have you come across anyone who actually has put forward a case where they have examined the other side or other sides, and they still land where they started? Do you know of anyone like that? I don't. There might be somebody out there, but I'm not fishing for something specific.
You mean in terms of investigating Mormonism or investigating any religion?
Anything. The second example that he gives, I don't know this Lee Strobel guy, but I mean, like, this sounds like he starts off as an atheist and then he becomes a Christian. So he has the character arc.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about somebody who they start off, they go and they explore everything, they weigh it, they give the good argument, the criticism, they put it out there, and then what they conclude is that they're right. Like, have you ever read anybody that does that? That you would agree with, or you know, would impress you? Because C.S. Lewis, no. This Lee Strobel guy, no. Richard Bushman.
Yeah, I mean, there's people out there who are certainly educated enough to where you could say that they've certainly investigated it and still landed kind of where they started. I mean, people like Richard Bushman, or I would even say Terrell Givens, is probably pretty equivalent to the closest thing Mormonism has to a C.S. Lewis.
See, but where they fall for me, and from what I've read of them, is I don't trust that they really looked at it from the other point of view. You know, like they didn't go far enough for me, and I can't really point to any examples of that. It was just the way that I felt. Like when I read Rough Stone Rolling, and he gets into Joseph Smith's head, and he starts this quasi-apologetic reasoning why it must lean this direction instead of any other possible motivations that it could have been. It's like, you're not really exploring everything here. But
right.
No, I think that's probably fair. But the closest thing you're going to find to somebody who's that well-educated on it that still believes.
Okay. So this is for listeners, if you're out there, if you understand what the hell I'm talking about and you know of something like that, let us know. And then we'll do a podcast about you.
Make a comment on the website, and you might be lucky enough to be mocked by four people without you present.
Or submit a listener essay, and we've been doing a lot of that lately, too. Come under our microscope.
Well, the problem is that, and I think, and I don't know this for sure, but it seems from my experience on the interwebs is that most people that leave Mormonism leave belief altogether. If they leave for intellectual reasons. Now, my sister left for social reasons, and she still believes in Jesus. If you leave for intellectual reasons, what happens is you get skeptical tools. You get the tools to analyze things objectively. And when you take those same tools that you took to Mormonism, to all other faith traditions, you generally come to the same conclusion that these are all of them have the fingerprints of man on them. All of them are self-serving. All of them are implausible. All of them are incompatible with modern science and research. And I think that's what generally happens if you don't have that really, really strong emotional connection to your faith tradition.
Yeah. I just looked up Lee Strobel on Wikipedia, and Born Again Mike left out a little detail that Lee Strobel started investigating Christianity after his wife became a Christian. And then he became a Christian too. So there may have been some other influences.
There. Yeah, and I looked up the book and that he talked about. What's it called? The Case for Christ.
Yeah.
I think it
for
was
a creator. The Case for a Creator.
I thought it was The Case for Christ.
Oh, there's both.
They're both by him.
Yeah.
He also wrote The Case for the Real Jesus and The Case for Faith.
Wow.
Well, everything's. He sounds like Bill O'Reilly.
Yeah. So he's not overplaying that whole I went to law school thing at all.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah.
Everything for him is the case for. Everything for Bill O'Reilly is killing. Yeah. Killing Lincoln, killing Kennedy, killing whoever. Mm-hmm. I don't know who's next. But
Jesus.
Killing Jesus, yeah.
No, didn't he write one? Didn't he write Killing
Jesus? Yeah, I think he did. Yeah. I think he did. Killing Jesus, killing Kennedy, killing Lincoln.
Right. And
killing John Stewart. Next?
Yeah.
And he's not close.
While we're on the subject of Mr. Strobel here, he went to law school, but he never became an attorney. He didn't pass the bar exam.
Nice.
He got into Yale. Well, by the way, Yale is the hardest school to get into.
I agree. But apparently,
and he got into Yale and he couldn't pass the bar.
All I know, he never took it. Maybe he didn't have the huevos.
Yeah. So,
or maybe just Jesus had another path for him in mind. Come on, Scott. Stop it.
That's just as likely.
Yeah. Well, getting back to the book that Born Again Mike brought up, The Case for Christ, he interviewed only, and he's supposed to be, like, what was it, the Chicago Tribune? He was an investigative reporter, and so he's using his skeptical investigative tools to investigate Christ. And guess what? He only interviews apologists, not one critic. Does he interview? That is crack investigative reporting there.
So he's not looking at the other side. He's only looking at talking with like-minded people. Is that what you're saying?
He only interviews like-minded people.
Oh, man.
And he only addresses the critics in a one-sided way where he criticizes them, but without giving them a chance to rebut. Mm-hmm. So he was the worst investigative reporter of all time.
Sitting on a jury case where only the prosecution was allowed to present its case.
That's why he couldn't pass the bar.
He never got it.
He never grasped that concept.
He's also a hardcore intelligent design advocate and very much against evolution. And I'm sorry, I know I made this point earlier, but I'm just, for the rest of my life, I'm just dismissing anybody who doesn't believe in evolution. I'm just not interested in arguing over it with them.
No, that's so, like somebody who...
to me to just dismiss them outright.
Yeah, they're not a reliable source. If they dismiss something that is more scientifically supported than germ theory of disease, then they're just not worth it. And that's, I guess, where we're coming to, Glenn, is how far do you have to go? Like, you could dismiss people that dismiss things that are like robustly, unequivocally established by science. I mean, if you come across someone who thinks that the moon landing is a hoax, do you really take them seriously?
No.
Well,
Oh, sweet Jesus!
I mean, that would be a long power cord to get up there and power those like cameras and stuff. They didn't have like wireless things back then. They didn't have Wi-Fi. I don't know. I'm just talking.
I know. You're just being funny.
I'm not actually.
I feel like somebody who believes in the moon landing conspiracy is probably, if I could sit down and talk to him about it, I feel like I could convince them a lot more easily than I could sit down and talk with somebody who's against evolution.
Yeah, because it's really hard to talk about endogenous retroviruses and transposons and
vestigial organs
the myriad of evidences for evolution.
The reason I don't doubt the moon landing is because I did see Ali G interview Buzz Lightyear about it, and he asked him point blank.
Booyakasha, check it out. I is here with none other than my main man, Buzz Aldrin. We know you've been axed this a zillion times. It must really get in your tits being axed it. But let's just sort it out. What do you say to all those conspiracy theorists who come up to you and say, does the moon really exist?
I don't think there are very many people who question whether the moon exists. It exists.
And all right, you have heard it here. It does exist. So all those people out there who are saying it don't, you was wrong.
That's right. The moon does exist, and we went there.
Yo, listen up. But how do they really know what exists and what is the conspiracy things? Because I know I have seen a picture of J-Lo. Apparently it weren't true.
I haven't seen those pictures.
Well, you should check them out. It's amazing.
Okay.
So listen up. You has heard about the moon and about space. You better learn about these things from my man Buzz Lightyear here. So you better realize that these things is important. Big up yourself.
Respect.
Respect. I love Ali G.
Booyakasha.
Sorry, Allison.
Have you ever watched Ali G, Allison?
No.
Why?
Send me some videos. I don't know.
You got to watch it, Allison.
Okay.
Why don't we tell Born Again Mike?
I'm Prison Mike.
He needs to go watch Ali G.
You do. You got to see the other side of things, Born Again Mike.
Yeah, that's the other side.
Oh, yeah.
Born Again Mike.
But that's the question. Is Born Again Mike being consistent? Is he?
He's listening to Infants on Thrones.
No, he does not.
He listened to the first part of his story on another site.
He's listening to us right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, Mike. Hey. Thanks for listening.
I think as soon as he hears Glenn's reading of his email where he's like stifling laughter. He's going to turn it off.
No.
You got to admit, though, I mean, how naive is it for you to say a good place to start is to read the New Testament? It's like, are you fucking kidding me?
Well, I think that it's kind of sweet. Like, he really, really doesn't know what Mormonism is at all. Like, this guy probably thinks that it is so culty and that we worship Joseph Smith and we
have
sex temple and we, you know, like did all these really weird things, like did not believe in the same Christ, believe in probably not even the same God.
We didn't.
Like probably thought Joseph Smith was God.
We do.
Shut up, Glenn.
Those are all right.
but she's all, I think her other point is that we don't even touch the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or that, you know, Christmas isn't just about Santa Claus. I would start with Christmas and what the real meaning of Christmas is before all of the liberals started trying to take it away from us.
Do you realize there's a war on Christmas?
Did you realize that?
We have to fight.
It's about Christ.
On Christmas.
It's about Christ.
Blitzkrieg on Grinchitude.
Yeah.
I purposely say to my patients, happy holidays, just to piss them off.
No, but seriously, what do you think he should start with? Because I think that that's a really good point. Like, has he really looked at the truth?
So to end, Allison would like to give Born Again Mike a recommendation of where he can start to get the other side of things. Take it away, Allison.
I think we all should think of something. I think he should start with a book that I'm reading currently called Why Does the World Exist? By Jim Holt. I recommended this book to Randy as well.
We want to do a podcast on it.
Yeah, that is a great book to start with because, I don't know if he could handle it, honestly. The grammar that he showed, it's kind of a tough book. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be rude, but it's kind of a toughie. So maybe that if he's feeling like he could handle it. What else? I think maybe he should read a little Neil deGrasse Tyson. Could start with that. Could watch some of his videos.
Yeah. Oh yeah, just watch Cosmos. Watch a couple episodes of Cosmos. Yeah. Hmm. I would say Who Wrote the Bible by is that Richard Friedman?
Friedman,
yeah. Richard Elliott Friedman.
Yeah, it's about the different sources and the way that the Old Testament was put together, and that's a very easy book to understand.
He probably doesn't read the Old Testament. He probably only reads the New Testament.
So it's a good place to start. Okay. The other side of the Bible.
There you go.
He knows the new. Look at the old, man. Take a look at it.
My suggestions would be just. One Bart Ehrman book. You could pick Misquoting Jesus.
The problem
actually
good,
a really
or the problem of was, evil.
Yeah, the problem of evil goes into how the Bible has no answers whatsoever for the problem of evil, and the problem of evil is a huge problem for a lot of non-believers.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't even touched on that, but Bart Ehrman. He doesn't really talk about how the problem of evil is solved, but he talks about how the Bible, all the different traditions in the Bible, from you know the prophet tradition to the wisdom tradition to the apocalyptic tradition, none of those have any good answers for why there is evil in the world. You know, why bad things happen to good people.
Well, they all have different. They all have different answers. I mean, they have an answer. They have a way they approach it, but
they have a way they approach it, but there's no solid.
There's no good answer.
There's right. They don't resolve it right. at all.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to go through why they approach it the way they did in that book. So any Bart Ehrman book, and I would recommend the podcast Reasonable Doubts.
Oh, come on.
Because that deals with counter apologetics. Christian counter-apologetics. So
infants on thrones, man.
We don't deal with Christian counter-apologetics.
Tell him to listen to us.
He obviously listens to apologetics. Listen to counter-apologetics, Reasonable Doubts.
And also listen to Infants on Thrones.
Thank you. Scott?
I would tell him to read The Greatest Show on Earth from Richard Dawkins. Mm. And see if you're not understanding evolution by the end of it, and if that doesn't cause you serious problems with your belief in Christianity from a born again perspective, then I'd be surprised.
Yeah. Watch any South Park episode, but stay away from Religious or anything by Bill Maher. Just stay away. don't go there.
The actual video it doesn't have the highest production quality, but I like is The God Who Wasn't There.
Yeah, it's a good documentary. Yeah,
it's a good one.
Documentary. Yeah,
especially for a Christian.
Yeah, and you know he likes to tout former atheists that become Christians. This is one former Christian who became an atheist, and I don't know this for sure, but I would bet dollars to donuts that it goes way more in the other direction.
Oh yeah,
former believers going to atheists.
Yeah,
I think a high percentage of the atheist community is former Christians that cared a lot about their faith, so much to the point where they investigated too deep and then realized it wasn't what it was cracked up to be.
Don't scare him away.
Yeah,
they had that study. They had that study though that showed that atheists knew the most about religion.
Yeah, well,
yeah.
But
atheists were the best educated about religions.
Look, we've given him a lot of things to go and look at. So read one of them. Go read one of the Left Behind books. Go read another one. Read another Left Behind book, and just keep balancing it out.
Yeah.
Like, watch good a job, Kirk Cameron movie.
Kirk Cameron on anything,
if
you know.
If you haven't heard of me, I wouldn't be surprised. I bet you know my relatives. Their names will never die. My mother is a saint, and my brother is a god. But all I am is Jesus, Brother Bob.
Jesus, Brother Bob. Jesus, Brother Bob. A nobody relative of the Son of God. If only I'd been born just a little sooner, I'd be more than the Brother of God Jr.
Hi, this is Sarah from Colorado Springs, Colorado, and I am an English girl hopelessly lost in a conservative American world. You can comment on this episode on the website infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. I did. Anyone for the closing prayer?
He died up on the cross. I thought that I was free. Finally, people would get to know me for me.
Hi, Bob.
Hey, Judas.
Hey.
This was my big chance to finally get ahead. The next thing you know, he's rising from the dead.
Jesus, Brother Bob. Jesus, Brother Bob. A nobody relative of the Son of God. If only I'd been born just a little sooner, I'd be more than the Brother of God.
Everybody.
Jesus, Brother Bob. Jesus, Brother Bob. A nobody relative of the Son of God. If only I'd been born just a little sooner, I'd be more than the Brother of God Jr.
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.